The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
On the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, there is a new chairman. His name is Jim Risch. He's a Republican from Idaho, and he is replacing Bob Corker from Tennessee, who has left the Senate. So Jim Risch, he's a pretty low-key guy. He's pretty supportive of the president and the president's policies. He gave a really interesting interview to USA Today a couple of days ago where he sort of laid out his priorities for that committee. And he said that his biggest foreign policy concern is China's expanding geopolitical influence, and that he would be taking a broader look at the reemergence of a competition between global powers. And he indicated that his first set of hearings will be on that topic. He also indicated that he has no plans for a hearing on Syria and no plans for legislation to ensure that the United States stays in NATO. So it's very interesting to read because it gives a little window into how he is sort of perceiving what his new chairmanship is going to be like.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 22nd, 2019. It's a new year with a new Congress, and the Democrats now control the House of Representatives. But how will that change affect the state of play for national security legal issues? To find out, Benjamin Wittes spoke last Friday to Brookings Senior Fellow and expert on all things Congress, Molly Reynolds, and Brookings Fellow, Lawfare Senior Editor, and former Chief Democratic Counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Margaret Taylor. They talked about the dynamics of a divided legislature, what committees Lawfare podcast listeners should keep an eye on, and how the new chairs of certain committees will affect key issues in national security law. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 385, Molly Reynolds and Margaret Taylor on National Security in the 116th Congress.
I want to start with what we can expect not to happen with Congress in, what is this, the 116th Congress?
It is the 116th Congress.
And can we just sweep off the table right at the outset major legislation and agree that what will be interesting about this Congress will not be its, or will, is not likely to be its legislative accomplishments, Molly?
I think so. I mean, there are, it's a little ironic to say what I'm about to say in the middle of a partial government shutdown, but appropriations work, budget work remains a thing that Congress generally has to do, and there's always some space in that arena for interesting things to happen. At some point, probably this summer or early fall, Congress will need to raise the debt limit, which is also always an interesting moment to be paying attention to Capitol Hill. But really beyond that, I'm not envisioning any major burst of bipartisanship or legislative productivity from this House and this Senate.
Margaret, in that vein, there are certain FISA authorities that are going to expire as part of the normal course of business. What is the legislative work that, in your estimation, even a Congress under these circumstances beyond routine appropriations, and we'll get to that in a minute because that's obviously an ongoing subject of controversy, but what's the legislative work that Congress will do because it has to and always does?
So I guess the main thing I would put in that category is the National Defense Authorization Act. That is a bill that has enjoyed broad bipartisan support year after year after year. It just tends to always get done. There's lots of support for it. What I think we might see is it might be a more slimmed down bill this Congress because of the dynamics of Democrats holding the House and Republicans in the Senate. But I do think there will be one. It may be slimmed down. And what we might see is these various authorizations getting maybe tacked onto it at opportune times as a vehicle that's definitely moving.
But you don't see, I mean, the last Congress had this, you know, surprise major sanctions bill, which you worked on. Are there any, if in your crystal ball, sort of areas where you kind of look and say, hey, there's a real sort of dark horse for major legislative action in this area, apart from the set of things that are coming because they have to come?
Not really. You know, having worked on Capitol Hill for 5.5 years, I can't emphasize enough how difficult it is to make predictions in the foreign policy and national security space, because often things that end up being really key are really driven by external events. They're things that happen in the world. And often what we see is something will happen. Members of Congress will want to make some kind of a response. And so they will either pick up something that's been pending for a while and go ahead and pass it, or write something anew that addresses the issue. And it's just really difficult, I think, to tell right now what that is going to be. I mean, I can say that, and I think, you know, this has flown below the radar screen a little bit. You know, Mitch McConnell has brought up his first bill in the Senate, S-1, which is called the Strengthening America's Security in the Middle East Act. And it's kind of a compilation of several different bills that passed committee in the last Congress, and relates to, you know, authorizing assistance and weapons transfers to Israel. It extends defense cooperation with Jordan, establishes additional sanctions relating to Syria, and allows states to divest from entities boycotting Israel. So Mitch McConnell has actually had no less than 3 procedural votes on this bill. They've all failed, generally speaking, I think because the Democrats in the Senate want to make a statement that, hey, you know, we're not really going to move forward on these types of things until the government shutdown is over.
All right. So let me try to sum up the legislative prospects in a fashion that you can both agree with. Nothing major will happen legislatively that isn't routine, must pass every year legislation unless something does.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's actually generally a decent summary of the contemporary Congress and its legislative productivity or lack thereof, as the case may be. But that's and I completely agree with Margaret's sentiment that external events can and do affect what Congress is capable of doing. So it can be difficult to, particularly in today's climate, to predict what might happen. But I think right now, if I were a betting woman, I'd feel pretty good about betting on the statement you just laid out, Ben.
All right. Which now brings us to a matter that you both alluded to, which is the shutdown. We're going to confine ourselves here to national security and international relations side of Congress, but obviously everything is affected by the shutdown, and everything, as Margaret just said, is delayed by the shutdown. So shutdown politics in Congress affecting the larger congressional work in this space. Margaret, your thoughts?
On the House side, I understand that the House committees actually will start sort of holding hearings in early February. And so it seems to me that on the House side, House Democrats have decided that, you know, they don't necessarily want the shutdown to totally, you know, not allow them to move forward with the work that they have planned. On the Senate side, it's the, you know, they've already started having hearings. But I do think that, you know, it creates just a very difficult sort of opening salvo dynamic about how all of this is going to work. And it's just a very tough situation. As I sit here, I'm not sure I see what the way is out of it or when that happens. It's going to hang over the work of both sides of Capitol Hill until it gets resolved. And in the same vein, I think, you know, what happens with the Mueller probe and the Russia investigation is along those same lines. Until we know how those two things play out, it's hard to make generalizations about what sort of the rest of the Congress will be like or what the Congress will be like generally.
All right. But so if you're imagining this Congress, as I think everybody was in December and still kind of is, as a big oversight-oriented Congress, not a legislative Congress, but a big oversight-oriented Congress. And you have this problem that if you're not talking about the shutdown, it's like you're kind of missing the boat in a fashion that kind of comes off as a little bit heartless, right? So, you know, if you're, for example, Chairman Cummings, right, and you're going to do oversight of, say, hurricane response, and you know, in the midst of a current crisis in which very large numbers of people are out of, are not working or are furloughed or working and not being paid, you kind of come off as like, I don't know, business as usual or business as expected and unresponsive to the current moment. So what's the relationship between the shutdown and the momentary crisis that we don't see an obvious way out of that relates to now?
Yeah, so I think this is sort of a can particularly the House of Representatives walk and chew gum at the same time kind of question. So is it the case that, and I think what we've seen so far in the first couple of weeks here, are that the House Democrats have chosen to use the House floor principally to keep pressure on the idea that the government is shut down. They are not the reason that it's not reopening. They passed a series of options for the Senate to take up if it wants to reopen the government in the form of short-term spending bills, in the form of longer-term spending bills for the parts of the government that aren't the Department of Homeland Security, so on and so forth. So to my mind, House Democrats have kind of taken the fact that they now control the floor agenda in the House and have scheduled a series of votes to keep the focus on the fact that the government is partially shut down, and then that they've started kind of in parallel, organizing the committees, assigning new members to committees. There's, I think, been some talk about whether that's been going more slowly than it would have if the government wasn't shut down. I don't think there's much to that. I think it's maybe proceeding slightly more slowly, but not majorly so as compared to other new Congresses where there's a change in party control. This Congress for Democrats has a very large new freshman class. It's a lot of work to figure out where to put all those new members with all of their interests and requests onto committees. And so I think as we're getting now to the point where House Democrats are filling out their committee assignments, and as Margaret indicated, they're going to start holding hearings on a wide range of oversight issues in the coming weeks.
And if I could just add, I mean, I see your point, Ben. Like, they've got a little bit of a political problem there that they're going to need to solve. I do think it's solvable. I think they can take whatever types of hearings that they are wanting to do and sort of spin them into talking about the shutdown. So, for example, at the beginning of each hearing, you know, talking about the shutdown, the importance of it, and, you know, connecting the shutdown to why the committee, the hearing that they're wanting to hold is important.
Although that will sound a bit forced, depending on the subject matter that they're talking about, right?
It could. But, you know, it's we'll have to see.
What about, I mean, let's leave aside House Republicans because they don't have any power, but Senate Republicans do. And, you know, there's a, in this space, as you, Margaret, suggested earlier, you know, Mitch McConnell actually does have certain legislative ambitions. Democrats aren't willing to talk to him about those as long as the shutdown is going on. But what do you see as the, obviously, the oversight interests of the Senate majority are going to be quite different from the oversight interests of the House majority. But if we agree that when the shutdown situation is over, on whatever terms, both House and Senate will turn to oversight questions because that's really what you're going to get done. And so what do you see before we turn to what the House Democrats are likely to do? What do you see the likely focus of Senate Republicans to the extent that they're in control of committees that, you know, kind of have to do something in this environment? Is it going to be, you know, sort of policy-oriented position stakeouts, or is it going to be like more along the lines of what, you know, House Republicans were trying to do last year in terms of investigating the investigation and its origins in with respect to the Russia stuff?
So for this question, I, of course, have to start with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is the committee that I worked on and I have a lot of love for. On the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, there is a new chairman. His name is Jim Risch. He's a Republican from Idaho, and he is replacing Bob Corker from Tennessee, who has left the Senate. So Jim Risch, he's a pretty low-key guy. He's pretty supportive of the president and the president's policies. He gave a really interesting interview to USA Today a couple of days ago where he sort of laid out his priorities for that committee. And he said that his biggest foreign policy concern is China's expanding geopolitical influence, and that he would be taking a broader look at the reemergence of a competition between global powers. And he indicated that his first set of hearings will be on that topic. He also indicated that he has no plans for a hearing on Syria and no plans for legislation to ensure that the United States stays in NATO. So it's very interesting to read because it gives a little window into how he is sort of perceiving what his new chairmanship is going to be like. And in addition, I just want to note on the Foreign Relations Committee, on the Republican side, it's a very interesting mix of people, and I will be watching the Republican side of the Foreign Relations Committee pretty closely. There's some new members to the Republican side, including Ted Cruz of Texas, Mitt Romney of Utah, Lindsey Graham will also be on the Republican side, and Rob Porter from Ohio is sort of returning to the Foreign Relations Committee. And all of those folks will be joining Marco Rubio of Florida, Rand Paul of Kentucky. So that will be a really interesting, I think, group of personalities to watch on the Republican side in the Senate.
But it sounds like from your description of Risch's interview, he is focusing probably quite intentionally on a major foreign policy challenge the United States faces, i.e. China, that does not antagonize the president.
I think that's right. And in fact, I think it is consistent with the administration's sort of focus on China and a desire to really sort of train the lens on China and away from other sort of awkward and uncomfortable issues like Russia.
Okay, so I want to explore whether this is a good idea for a moment. On the one hand, I know a lot of liberal listeners will say that's really frustrating. You know, he should be poking the administration on North Korea. He should be challenging the administration on Russia policy. He should be. But I kind of look at it and say, wow, you know, there actually really is a danger that the great confrontation and challenge of our time between us and China gets lost in the current anti-Trump and pro-Trump headbutting that's going on. And so if I'm the chairman of the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, actually spending time on this is a good way to use time because, like, it's something that many members of the committee, Republican and Democrat, will actually agree on. It's a challenge that's real, that's substantial, and that you don't have to lock horns with the president to spend time with on. So my question is this a good move by Jim Risch and a productive area for this committee to be spending time on? Or should we think of this as Republican sort of duck and cover with respect to Trump, or maybe a kind of bit of both?
I think it's almost certainly a bit of both. I mean, there are for sure real issues in the China space that I think have not gotten enough attention. So there's absolutely real issues there that a committee like the Foreign Relations Committee can valuably take up, taking a longer term view, taking the broad policy view. So there's definitely there on the China issues. And, you know, just to also say with respect to Senator Risch, you know, he has said publicly that he does have disagreements with the president, and he addresses those disagreements with the president in private. And, you know, who's to say that that might be the better way in some respects to deal with the president rather than sort of coming at him frontally, which made a difficult time for in the past. So
including for his predecessor.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But it's true there will be people who will be disappointed that the committee and maybe some of these other committees don't seem to be taking up the most pressing foreign policy challenges that are we're facing right now. And Syria, I think definitely falls into that category.
All right. So before we turn to the House, let's just talk about two other committees, both of which have changed leadership in the Senate. Everybody's focusing on the House changes in leadership, but you know, the Senate committees have actually, you know, there's a hell of a turnover. One is Jim Inhofe taking over Armed Services, and the other is Lindsey Graham taking over for Chuck Grassley on Judiciary, which we got a view of this week at Bill Barr's confirmation hearing. Molly, what do you expect the consequences of those changes to be, if any?
Right. So I think the point about Senator Graham taking over leadership of the Judiciary Committee is quite important, particularly because to our broader point about kind of what's the Senate going to do for the next 2 years, I expect much of their focus to be on continuing to confirm nominees to both the federal judiciary and to the extent that there are unfilled positions in the executive branch that the Trump administration is interested in filling, spending a lot of time sort of moving through things that are on what we call the Senate's executive calendar, so nominations. And that's in large part because thanks to changes in Senate precedent, the Republicans do not need to work with Democrats to clear a 60-vote threshold on those nominations. They can do those on a simple majority basis. And as a result, that's just an avenue for them to do a lot of things that they want to get done. Leader McConnell has made no secret of the degree to which he sees filling the federal judiciary with conservative nominees to be part of his central purpose as the Senate majority leader. So I think to the extent that that's going to be a place where the Senate spends a lot of its time, how Lindsey Graham chooses to lead the Judiciary Committee is going to be consequential. On Senator Inhofe taking over leadership of the Armed Services Committee, as Margaret mentioned earlier, the National Defense Authorization Act is the sort of thing that the Senate does take up every year. And so watching the committee put that together under Inhofe's full leadership for the first time, I think, will be worth watching. That's also a committee that has some new members, folks like Martha McSally, the new senator from Arizona, or one of the new senators from Arizona, I should say, is serving on that committee. So that'll, again, and given that some aspects of defense policy are things that the Senate tends to do even in very contentious partisan times, that'll be a committee of consequence as well.
I want to ask one question for both of you on that specific leadership transition. John McCain was a person of enormous bipartisan respect, and in his latter years, although not in his earlier years, a great bipartisan affection in the Senate. And he was somebody who often crossed party lines and made a point of working with Democrats on all kinds of things, particularly in the context of that committee. Jim Inhofe is not that. He is a pretty divisive, sort of among the more partisan people in either party in the Senate, and certainly a very, I think it's fair to say, less admired than McCain in terms of stature. And so my question is, what is the effect on that committee of going from somebody like McCain to somebody like Inhofe in the context of this? The work of that committee in substantial part is the production of the National Defense Authorization Act every year. It never misses, right? So now what happens when Inhofe is in charge of that?
So it's hard to say exactly, but I think that it will maybe seemed like a slightly more low-key committee. With John McCain at the helm of Armed Services, you know, it was just high energy. He was not afraid to, you know, express his views when he didn't agree with what the Department of Defense and the administration was doing. He sort of sought to recreate the Department of Defense in his image. He just had very strong views, oversight views. Inhofe is not the same, I don't think. And so I think it will be more low-key. I think he will, you know, be primarily interested in really understanding what authorities the Department of Defense would like and obtaining those authorities for the Department of Defense. So I think that it will be sort of a very much less sort of confrontational and probably a little bit less energetic scene that we'll see in the Armed Services Committee.
And will it be less bipartisan? I mean, you bipartisanship is not a word that we throw around in these days, particularly on the Hill, very much. But that committee has functioned in a genuinely bipartisan fashion over a pretty long period of time now. You know, Inhofe is the guy who brought a snowball to Capitol Hill to protest the existence of climate change. That's remembered on the other side. And so I'm just interested how Democrats are likely to feel about, you know, an Inhofe chairmanship.
I think it probably will be a little less bipartisan, but there is just a very strong tradition of that committee being bipartisan. I don't think that's going to fade right away. One thing I'm sort of watching and looking at is to see, you know, if President Trump decides to declare a national emergency to use, you know, extra Pentagon funds that have already been appropriated to build a wall on the southern border, you know, my question is, how does Inhofe react to that? Because that's a situation where, you know, that's his agency.
Those are his funds.
Yes,
yeah.
Those are his funds. It's his committee of jurisdiction. How does Inhofe handle that when it comes down to brass tacks? And so that's one thing I'll kind of be watching to see how he handles that and how Democrats on the committee, in particular Jack Reed, who's the ranking member and has, you know, been doing that job for a long time, tons of experience, how the two of them end up working together if that is something that is going to sort of poison the relationship.
One other thing to kind of keep in mind that may continue to encourage some bipartisanship among defense-minded senators in the next year is that one thing on the budget side that Congress needs to do this year is make a decision about whether or not to raise again the discretionary spending caps that have been in place since 2011. And those include caps on both defense spending and non-defense spending. And one thing that we've seen basically every 2 years since 2011 is Congress eventually figure out a way to please both the defense hawks on the Hill and those folks who care about non-defense discretionary spending and raise those spending caps. And so that'll be, I think, in some ways, a shared interest of members in both parties who really care about defense spending. And that may also help to continue to encourage bipartisanship among the Republicans and Democrats in the Senate who really want to see an increase in the defense budget.
One more Senate question. This is an area that, you know, it's odd for the Lawfare podcast to have gone this long talking about the Senate without talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee. But this is the one committee that has seemed like it is behaved in a almost entirely bipartisan fashion in the midst of the Russia investigation. We still don't know when to expect what from that investigation, but it does still seem to me anyway like Chairman Burr and Vice Chairman Warner are working extremely closely together. What can we say, Margaret, about what we know about where things are and where things are headed in that regard?
It seems like it's been pretty quiet lately, but I do think they are continuing to work closely together, as you said. I do think, though, that in some respects, people are waiting to sort of see what happens on the House side with Adam Schiff as chairman of the House Intel Committee, because I do think that's going to have an impact on Senator Burr and Senator Warner's efforts potentially. Maybe it means that, you know, they can sort of hunker down and do their work and not have as much attention focused on them, which might be good for their efforts. So we'll see how that turns out. I do think that with respect to Senator Burr, you know, in the last Congress, I do think there was a sense that having Senator McCain and Senator Corker in the chairmanships that they were in, providing a little bit of sort of cover for Senator Burr and his efforts, that was sort of a valuable thing. And that's sort of gone now. So I don't know how that plays out. Ultimately, really, it will only really know when the Mueller investigation ends, I would think.
So I just want to take this opportunity, as I always do when this subject comes out, to say that Richard Burr deserves a huge amount of credit, because in this environment, with Devin Nunes behaving the way he did, with some members of his caucus in the Senate, including Chuck Grassley and sometimes Lindsey Graham, really behaving quite badly, and he is from a red state or a purplish, a red-leaning purple state that voted for Trump, and he managed to actually just knuckle down and do his work and let his committee do his work and not fracture along party lines. And I do think, you know, in the environment in which we watched that not happen in a lot of places, we really do have to give credit where it is the reality that was allowed to persist. All right, let's talk about the House. Molly, give us an overview. What can we reasonably expect from which committees? If it's going to be an oversight Congress, oversight is all about committee chairmen and their staffs. So who are we talking about here?
Sure. So I think certainly for kind of Lawfare's core set of issue areas of interest, the three big committees to watch in the House will be what's now called the Committee on Oversight and Reform. I will spend most of the next 2 years accidentally continuing to call it
Government Reform and Oversight.
Exactly. But it is called the Committee on Oversight and Reform. It is chaired by Congressman Elijah Cummings.
It will always be the watermelon shooting committee to me.
Congressman Cummings of Maryland chairs that committee. He has a long tenure on that committee and has been an active member for quite some time. The second big committee to watch in the House in the Lawfare space is the House Judiciary Committee, chaired by Jerry Nadler of New York. And then obviously the House Intelligence Committee, chaired by Adam Schiff of California. There are also, it's important to remember that there are all House committees have some oversight jurisdiction, and different committees will be doing work in specific oversight work in specific issue areas. So things like the House Ways and Means Committee and the possibility of obtaining President Trump's tax returns, for example, and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, which is chaired by Elliot Engel of New York, has reinvigorated a subcommittee to do investigative work specifically. So there may be some interesting stuff that comes out of that committee as well. But to your point, Ben, now that Democrats have a majority in the House, these individual chairmen and the choices that they make about which investigations to pursue and on what timeline and the kinds of staff that they hire to support them in that effort will be really important. So there was some reporting this week on some new staff that Schiff has hired for the Intelligence Committee that are aimed at helping that committee do investigative work going forward. But again, the oversight and reform, judiciary and intelligence, I think, are the big three to watch in this area, this Congress.
So, Margaret, it's kind of interesting, like you started on the Senate side by talking about Senate foreign relations. And when it comes to House side, House Foreign Affairs is not one of the big three here, right? Molly kind of mentioned it in passing along with Ways and Means. So what is the difference between the Senate side Foreign Relations Committee and the House side Foreign Affairs, that one of them is a, you know, is a big deal committee to watch and the other one's kind of a, like, oh yeah, them too?
You know, I'm not sure I'd agree with that characterization. House Foreign Affairs Committee is obviously a very important committee on the House side. I think for me, in looking at the landscape on the House side, you know, I'm looking at Chairman Adam Schiff, who has kind of been the kind of spokesperson for the House Democrats on a lot of these, on the Russia issues, on just a lot of these issues that are coming up that are core to foreign policy and national security. And I see Adam Schiff's role really growing beyond the sort of normal parameters of what you'd think of as a House, the House Intelligence Committee. So I think it's more sort of just looking at the different personalities there. I see Adam Schiff's sort of his stature sort of growing and his visibility growing. Elliot Engel of House Foreign Affairs Committee has been there a long time. He's got tons of experience. I know they are staffing up on their oversight function. And so we'll just have to see sort of what comes out of that committee. The House Foreign Affairs Committee has also traditionally been a very bipartisan committee. And so in that respect, it may be the case that what they do tends to not garner all of the headlines that, for example, the dynamic between Adam Schiff and Devin Nunes might.
All right. I want to advance a radical proposition and have you guys shoot it down if you're inclined. Radical proposition is there actually isn't a big three. There's a big two for lawfare purposes. And here's the reason. Judiciary has the impeachment authority, and intelligence has a skiff and a genuine ability to see all the intel. And those are the two things that actually really matter at the end of the day for oversight purposes. And therefore, they will dominate the biggest of the oversight questions. And that will force Elijah Cummings into investigating things that aren't at the center. He'll do, you know, hurricane response. He'll do emolument stuff at the Trump International Hotel. But the core Russia stuff, even notwithstanding that he's the guy, Cummings is the guy who's got Cohen coming in February, notwithstanding that, the core, the real action is going to be initially in House Intelligence, because they're the ones who can actually get the classified material and see it and process it. And then at some point, if it shifts into an impeachment inquiry, it shifts over to Judiciary and everything else will round to zero. Am I wrong?
So one thing I think this proposition illustrates really well is the different things that we talk about when we're talking about a big oversight Congress. And when we think about kind of an effective oversight strategy, it includes both the kind of high profile, showy, get coverage on national television type hearings that I think, as you pointed out, the Cohen hearing before Oversight and Reform is likely to in early February. Those have a place in the kind of approach to oversight. Hearings like that are really great if you want to try and, as best you can, force someone to state something on the record and potentially embarrass them in front of a very large audience. But at the same time, a lot of really effective and important oversight work goes on behind the scenes and happens through letters that are exchanged between committees and the executive branch over requests for information, whether all of that information actually gets turned over at the when congressional committees request it is another matter. So I think a lot of that sort of work will be happening much more perhaps on Judiciary and in the Intelligence Committee in the coming 2 years, though, again, I expect some of that to happen on oversight as well. So I just think I take your point. But I think when we think about why House Democrats are pursuing oversight aggressively and what the different tools they have at their disposal are, then we're going to see different ones being used in different ways by the different panels.
What do you think? So I take Molly's point as a really important corrective to my there's kind of more than one level at which this stuff goes on, right? There's the major gestalt confrontation between the legislative branch and the executive branch. And then there's actually the day-to-day task of oversight of agencies, right? And so granted that that point is correct, is it fair to amend my point to say, all right, I'm talking only about the sort of highest profile stuff, or is that wrong too?
I think it would be hard to argue against what you said, Ben. It is hard. I mean, these are huge issues right now, the Russia investigation, the potential for impeachment. I mean, these are the biggest types of issues that, you know, our government basically can face. So it's hard to argue against. I guess the one thing I would say is it's so, and this goes back to a point I made earlier, it is often so hard to tell that something could come out of left field and become the most important thing that's going on. And I just saw this sort of happen over and over when I was working in the Senate. So I guess I would just say a caveat with, like, we don't know. Something might happen. What if there's a war overseas that starts, that the U.S. becomes involved in? That could, you know, overtake all of this, and then the attention could shift somewhere else. I would also say that, you know, Elijah Cummings is no wallflower, and I don't see a situation where he gets eclipsed by anyone. In particular, he has done some just really kind of, I think, amazing oversight work from the minority position in the House when Democrats were in the minority. And so he will not be eclipsed by anyone, I think.
That's in part because of Cummings personally, but it's in part because of kind of the recent history of that committee. And so if we think about sort of the period when the Republicans controlled the House, that committee was alternatively was led for a while by Daryl Issa, was led by Jason Chaffetz. So it became a very kind of center of partisan conflict in Congress. And even going back to the Clinton years and Dan Burton, who famously issued 1,000 subpoenas from his chairmanship as the of that committee. And so it has this kind of institutional history that I think is also at this moment going to make it a place where we still see plenty of action for that reason as well.
If I were Elijah Cummings, I would focus like a laser beam on family separation and hurricane response, right? High profile, really, really important, and non-competitive with what would be going on in these other areas. All right. So I want to talk about, before we wrap up, I want to talk about what the pitfalls are. So the name Dan Burton has come up a few times. He represents the human embodiment of some of these pitfalls, right? That you both in the sense of low quality of oversight, but also in the sense of both relentless partisanship and also hyper-energetic, conspiracy theory-driven annoyance oversight. And Trump gives a lot of opportunity for that stuff because he goes boo and you want to send a subpoena in response. You want to do whatever you can. And I think being a committee chairman under the circumstances of Donald Trump could turn a reasonable person into a Dan Burton awfully quickly. And so I'm interested in both of your sense of what the reasonable restraining mechanisms are. How do you know if you're Adam Schiff or Elijah Cummings or Jerry Nadler or Maxine Waters, right? How do you know which is the marginal subpoena that you actually should send? Which is the marginal witness that you actually should call? And where that is kind of verging into Dan Burton land or Daryl Issa land? The House oversight over the last 20 years has very rarely shrouded itself in glory in the hands of either party. So what's the road back to making this a real mechanism of accountability rather than an independent clown show in its own right?
So I'll say a couple things. One, to pick up on something you said a little while ago about Chairman Cummings and what you would focus on if you were him, is I think there are plenty of things that are on the table that are both questions about the conduct of the executive branch over the last 2 years, but are also questions about policy and that have had real consequences for Americans. And I think that there's a lot of space. You mentioned the family separation crisis. You mentioned hurricane recovery. I think those are two places. I think it's also telling that one of the first things that Cummings has moved on as oversight chair has to do with prescription drug pricing. Again, something where there's a lot of, I think, public attention to a problem. So kind of establishing that baseline of we're going to do things that matter to Americans, but are also about kind of dysfunction in the executive branch over the past 2 years. So that's one thing I'll say. The other thing that I'll say is that I think it's going to be really important to remember that, you know, the subpoena is in many ways the biggest or one of the biggest guns any of these people have in their arsenal. And it's probably not where you want to start. And so I actually was somewhat encouraged by the fact that Matt Whitaker is scheduled to appear before the House Judiciary Committee the first week of February. And that ultimately did not require the issuance of a subpoena. It's my understanding that Nadler threatened a subpoena if that was necessary, but that both sides came to an agreement that Whitaker would appear without the actual issuance of a subpoena. And that's really kind of how the congressional subpoena power has historically worked, that the subpoena is a backstop that kind of forces people into compliance. And so it's at least, and obviously that's an N of one, we're in the first couple of weeks of this Congress, who knows where we go. But it's somewhat promising to me that at least in that case, coming out of the gate, we did not see it have to escalate all the way to 10 from zero right away to get someone from the administration to come testify in the House.
Okay. So I want to follow up on that, because the subpoena, the congressional subpoena, is one of those funny instruments that sounds super powerful and like, oh, you'll subpoena it and you'll get it. And unlike a grand jury subpoena, you know, FBI agents are not going to show up and throw you in jail and hold you in, you won't be held in contempt and jailed until you produce the stuff if you don't respond to a congressional subpoena. And so my question is, how much of the historic value of executive branch oversight through the legislature is simply a matter of comedy between the branches that we actually shouldn't expect to exist in this environment, and that what we're actually going to learn when, if and when subpoenas start issuing, is that they don't have a lot of teeth behind them, and that the executive branch can actually smile and say, come and try to enforce it?
Yeah, I mean, if you look back, this is on the question of the subpoena power. If you look back to how when Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, invoked executive privilege to not turn over various documents to Daryl Issa at the time, chairman of that House Government Reform Committee, Daryl Issa's committee did file a lawsuit in federal court in the District of Columbia, and it took a full 3.5 years. For that legal action to move through the system and for opinion to be issued with respect to the validity of the invocation of executive privilege. 3.5 years is longer than 2 years. That is, 2 years is the length of the Congress. And so I think it's instructive for Americans to really understand the realities of what a subpoena means, and that in truth, almost certainly the discussion will be a back and forth between the executive and the legislative branch. And the White House, the new White House counsel has apparently staffed up, hired 17, new lawyers to help vigorously invoke President Trump's executive privilege when those subpoenas do start coming. So it's going to be sort of quite a battle, and it's not a sure thing that, as you say, that the subpoena will necessarily produce the types of quick results that I think a lot of people out there are hoping to see.
Yes, I'll say two things to add to what Margaret said, which I generally agree with. One is that while the White House has reportedly staffed up to prepare itself for this, the House has as well. So the new general counsel of the House is someone who people sort of read his hiring as someone who came in with the possibility to probability that some of these subpoena fights will end up in court. The other thing that I'll say about sort of fights over subpoenas is that I certainly agree that there are situations in which the Trump administration is likely to welcome a fight with Congress about a subpoena. And then I think in those situations, we have to think about how does that fit into the broader political narrative about kind of where the Trump administration is, where it's going, what's Congress doing? How do we think about kind of big separation of powers type fights coming out of a 2-year period when we've seen relatively few of them because Republicans controlled both chambers of Congress?
And I would just also add that, you know, this Congress is in the shadow of the 2020 presidential election. And so almost everything that the Trump administration does will be viewed through that lens. And it may be the case that, as you say, Molly, you know, hews to the president's sort of benefit to just be seen as fighting this and being obstinate.
For this audience, it is worth spelling out what Molly just alluded to about the general counsel of the House, who is Nancy Pelosi hired Doug Letter, who was formerly the head of the Justice Department's Civil Appellate Division and is an enormously respected appellate lawyer, mostly on behalf of the executive branch, is how he has spent his career. But he resigned from that office probably about a year ago and has been at Georgetown since. And I definitely do read Doug's hiring by Pelosi as a sign that she wants, you know, not merely excellent counsel, but excellent counsel on these sort of separation of powers, document production matters for appellate litigation, right? And I think it's a very interesting hire and a quite inspired hire on her part. Molly, Margaret, thanks so much. And let's do this again early and often and keep track of Congress in this space as these matters start to heat up.
Absolutely.
I look forward to it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please give the Lawfare Podcast a review and rating wherever you listen to us. This episode of the podcast was audio engineered by Michaela Fogel and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.